press on in fellowship. It's the only way to do it. I got to get myself in fellowship too. Not necessarily right now. I mean, all right, we're on page 7, and I read the verses, so it's a big block of verses. I should have probably broke it up, but I didn't. Anyway, the human author here is a point 19. Is a person who, according to Qoheleth, now that, of course, that word means preacher. It's Hebrew for preacher. That's how he introduces himself in the book a couple times. A person who's in the hand of God cannot be sure whether God's favor or displeasure awaits them. I know sometimes I wonder too, but doctrine helps to sort that out. This line of reasoning is reinforced in verse 2. It does not matter how a person lives their life, the same hate happens to everyone. 22, it does not matter whether a person is righteous, wicked, clean, unclean, offers sacrifices, it does not, sinner, swears an oath, etc. Fate is used in Ecclesiastes of death, as noted. It is used both of humans and animals, as demonstrated in 2:7-14. It is not death that alone is the problem, but the timing and the finality of death. The same destiny awaits everyone. It does not matter whether someone worships God or does not. The good and the sinner suffer the same fate. Verse 3 demonstrates how one fate for all affects all people. He describes it as evil or bad, suggesting that perhaps it is a moral evil, since there is no distinction in God's treatment of the righteous versus the wicked. Furthermore, he goes on to observe that God's treatment fosters evil among people in verse 3b. The implication is that when, and that's where that comes in, you can extract that verse out of there and say, yes, this is true of the human race. Insanity dwells in the hearts of the human race and so forth. The implication is that when there is no relationship between how one lives and how one dies, this encourages people to engage in evil. And I would say that this stupidity affects certain people because they see people who are readily getting by with all kinds of stuff and they're doing well and nothing bad, as they can tell, as far as they can tell, is happening to them. This is a problem that the righteous have had from time to time with regard to the observation of the human race. Why are they doing so well and everything's going good for them and they are not suffering the kinds of things that maybe you suffer or others suffer? Well, that is very short-sighted, and one needs to completely get over that nonsense and learn doctrine and realize what their end is and that what the end of the righteous is, and not base anything on your experiential situation at any given time. Because all the prophets and all the great believers suffered. We're in a world that's antagonistic to us. And therefore, there's a certain amount of suffering that comes to every one of us, and we can't avoid it. Even if a person got by in life with no suffering at all, it's hard to imagine, and ended up, what good is it? It's all vanity if they die and wind up in hell. So when people realize that they gain nothing by being good, the result is the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. A similar sentiment is found back in chapter 8, verse 11. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly. Now, the sentence against an evil deed could be humans executing a sentence against an evildoer, or it could be simply God isn't stepping in and stopping these people. Therefore, the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully over to do evil. Well, a lot of people fall for that. A lot of people fall for this. And their mentality is, these people aren't getting in trouble, so I'm going to do it. That is crazy, but that's the insanity part. Because they forget that God will intervene and God will deal with it. It's just not on our time scale. The common destiny, death, for the righteous and the wicked encourages people to engage in evil, irrational and unprincipled lives, because there's no reason to live a righteous life. Why should they? They'll do it the way they want to do it. The final clause in verse 3 shows the outcome of those who live corrupt lives. The verse ends abruptly, and afterwards, to the dead, that's literally following the Hebrew, which reflects the suddenness of death in the midst of life. Those who are full of evil, are subject to an unexpected and premature death from time to time, not always. So he makes it clear that always doesn't happen that way. But since the same fate awaits the righteous, this is what bothered or seemed to bother him. In several verses, Q is going to make several points about life. Verse 4 seems to make a positive statement about life. This verse does not appear to be giving a reason for the statement in verse 3 that the common fate for all evil types is death. Verse 4 is highlighting life over death. The word "for" should be translated "indeed." Indeed, whoever is joined with all the living, there is hope. Again, this is not the hope that we get from doctrine. This is simply the hope that they're alive and they can move forward. They're not dead yet. At the end of verse 4, he offers a proverb to explain that hope that is connected to the living. A live dog is better than a dead lion. A lion is a fierce and majestic animal associated with royalty. Dogs did not always have the high esteem among people that they typically have among us today. And a dog was also, when calling someone a name like that, it was very derogatory. Called someone a lion, they wouldn't mind that. But you don't call them a dog. When I take my grandson to the barber every other Friday lately, his barber said, he was telling me about he got to go to the basketball game, the pro game down here, the Thunder. She said, "You lucky dog." Graham says, "I am not a dog." He hasn't been able to process that yet. It was not a bad thing. She did it twice on two occasions. He caught her both times. It was a term of contempt in that culture, more or less. And though dogs have come way up the ladder in human estimation, we have dog shows and everything else, still, at the very least, a dog is a lesser animal than a lion. A lion, by its very nature, commands a certain amount of attention that maybe a dog does not. This is not an unqualified endorsement of life, only that life is better than death. At the beginning of verse 5, he gives a reason for the hope of verse 4a, and why he compares life to a contemptible dog. For the living know they will die, but the dead do not know anything. The advantage the living have over the dead is consciousness, specifically with regard to life on earth and things that are going on. Now, for the dead, for the righteous, for the unbeliever, it's unimaginable suffering. They do have a consciousness, the unbelievers, of their life back on earth. They are fully aware of that. They didn't lose. That isn't all blotted out in death. The rich man in hell, conversing with Abraham, knew that he was a rich man and that he had 7 brothers back on earth. And Lazarus, the bum, who was a believer, who was a reversionist, and had reduced himself to doing what the psalmist said, "I have not seen the righteous begging for food," is scavenging from the rich man's table in the garbage he set out, with all kinds of sores on his body. Really miserable. Under the sin and the death, he died, and Abraham said he's being comforted. And the comfort of phase 3 is different in the comfort from phase 2 because it's perfect and it's there in every way. The rich man had no advantage over that, and so he dies and he lifts up his eyes in hell. There's a citation in Ezekiel that says that men that were killed on a battlefield, when the ones who killed them joined them in hell, it gives them some satisfaction. They're there now too. So people know this. Hell has been depicted in a lot of ways by theologians and others. hell is not a place where people are in such extreme pain they cannot even talk to each other or converse. I figured that out of Scripture. The rich man's talking to Abraham. If you were in so much pain from heat, you wouldn't be talking to anybody. Would you? How could you? You are just writhing in anguish. This is a thought I had on that. All these doctrines get developed. You think about stuff. You have all these scriptures. You piece together everything on a topic. You don't just isolate on one thing. And oh God, my view of hell is yes. There's nothing but hopelessness, complete hopelessness. A person on death row at least has some kind of hope that they might get a pardon. These people have no hope, and yet they are able to recognize each other and still suffer. When people... Oh, I got one more for you, and I'll let you go. Not from here. I got one more for you. When Satan comes down to hell at the second advent, he is mocked by the human race. He is not their hero anymore. Who are you who have come down? And there's this big speech in Isaiah, not big, but a real dramatic speech that's put together by the human race. You who weak, they're chiding him. He's not the hero. You who weakened the nations. They're facing up to the fact that he's the one that deceived them on so many topics, and especially with regard to eternal salvation. They're still culpable. Because Satan's out there blinding people to the truth. It's what he does. And so he fosters all these things to mess people up. And boy, is he good at it. And it's easy because most people are a pushover. If he can fake out people who have lived through the millennium or a part of the millennium and deceive the nations at the end, and they buy into his new propaganda, because you'll have to have some fresh propaganda. The old stuff isn't going to work. He has to have some fresh propaganda that they can overcome and overcome this rule of Christ that's been going on for 1,000 years. And it'll take a while to sell them on this. It's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. People who are in relative, perfect environment and can see the righteous and can see Christ and can see all the phenomenal things beyond my ability to communicate to you. The complete change in the animal kingdom. Where your little child can play with or somebody's little child can play with a cobra, one of the most deadly snakes that is out there, and have it as a pet. I'm thinking, what do you have to do to the okay, that's not on this subject, but you have to do to the physiology of these carnivores that they can go around and eat foliage, roughage. That's where I just take the Bible by faith. I'll just have to wait to see how, none of those animals could survive a minute eating. Your dog couldn't survive a minute. They might eat grass because their stomach's upset, or for whatever reason dogs do some of the dumb things they do. It'll kill him. He'll die. He needs meat. Some of the people in the church figure out here that raw meat is what dogs thrive on, because that's their heritage. And all these grains and everything people are putting off on them, another subject, is killing them, making them lethargic. Oh well, even our pets suffer. But consciousness is not a great advantage, because the living walk around all the time knowing they're going to die. Verse 4a is considered to be sarcastic because the living has no real hope at all. Or put another way, the one thing the living are certain about is that they will die. This concept dominates their lives. They think about it all the time, because they immediately hear someone died and they relate it to themselves. But God has taken the sting out of death for us. And so Paul can even mock death. Oh, death, personifies it. Oh, death, where is your sting? Oh, grave, where is your victory? You don't have a permanent victory. You have a temporal victory, a partial victory, but not a permanent one for the righteous. What this prospect means is developed in verses 5, 6, and B. Not only do the dead lack consciousness, but there's no longer reward because their memory is forgotten. There's a wordplay between the words reward, sakar, and memory, zekar. The legacy or reputation of a person means little after they're gone because people forget about them. The dead lack the one reward that could be theirs because they are no longer remembered. The dead are further described in verse 6. Their opportunity to participate in the experiences of life is gone because their love, their hate, their zeal, or envy, as some take it, have already perished. So they will no longer share in all that is done under the sun, quote unquote. Share refers to limited enjoyment that is available to people who are alive, even though there is no ultimate profit to labor. It doesn't get you over that hump and it helps you bypass death. This anticipates Q's advices, verses 7 through 10. His comments on death in these verses show that being alive is better than being dead. Life is not necessarily completely a positive thing. In these verses, there is another call to enjoyment. Other calls to enjoyment include in those verses. So it's a pattern through the book. And one I have tried to point out to you is there's some merit in it. And the merit is, enjoy your life. Enjoy the fruits of your labor. Don't be excessive. And, of course, I would add, and be willing to help others. Don't just be selfish. Look out for the needs of others. Be conscious of their needs. That's why I try to teach here. Be aware of the believers in the royal family. And how you become aware is through prayer and that you can help people. You can help other believers. You can encourage them. You know, this is not hard to do. You don't have to have money to do this. You do not marginalize people who are trying and coming to Bible class. Because they're not maybe on the right, completely on page with something. You show them kindness. You give them basic, fundamental encouragement. A genuine, good to see you. You know, and coming from a certain person, that might be really helpful because they might think you don't like them at all and you walk past them with your nose up in the air. Or you, have you ever been avoided like you didn't exist, like you were invisible? You say, yeah. Okay, now you know how it feels, don't you? Don't do that to members of the royal family. We have people here, they're in all walks of life, they come from all different situations. And until you know everything about them, and how could you, by just hearing, well, he did that stupid thing. Well, you could hear that about anybody and formulate a complete opinion of him and lock him up under that. I don't like that. It's not the filling of the Spirit, ever. We had this in the Fundy churches. You know, certain people were looked down on because they didn't conform to everything they thought they ought to be. You hated that too when you were there, I hope. It wasn't pleasant. So reassess and reevaluate your attitude towards members of the royal family here. Do you know there are people that quit coming to Bible class because they simply had somebody in their mind did them something wrong and they just couldn't sit here with them in class, even though they were friends? What? You get them aside and make amends. I've seen people do it the right way. Made amends. God set up an opportunity. They did it. And we all go on. We can't harbor this junk. This isn't appropriate. If God treated us this way, we'd all be toast. He does not treat us this way. He forgives us 7 times 7. He forgives us over and over again. Why do some people resent that? Because I don't do that. That's the self-righteous types. The holier-than-thou crowd. Just some exhortations from your pastor, teacher, with regard to behavior, with regard to the royal family. Do not discriminate. I don't say the person has to be your close category, get together every Friday night friend. But you can treat them in grace and encouraging. And some of you do it well. And some need to work on it. Because you're selective. And I'm doing this in general. You let every man judge and evaluate his own heart and his own attitude. Now, if somebody's doing something that, you know, rubs you the wrong way, well, I understand that. But still, are you saying they're never in fellowship and they don't apply doctrine at all? And in the worst case scenario, if you don't forgive somebody something, you're stuck. You are stuck in the mud. You can go through all the other motions, come to church, do this, do this, do this. But if you're unwilling to forgive as Christ forgave, you will not move forward spiritually. I had a woman, she came here briefly. She told me she had all her, for the many years since her husband left her for another woman, she had hated him and held him in contempt, and she was bitter. And she says, as a result of your teaching, I saw through that. That's the kick in the head. You get betrayed once, and then you carry it around miserable all your life. What is that? Okay, the person's dead to you. Least you can do is go on and not spend your time sticking pins in an effigy of him. I don't get it. I know some are harder to forgive than I don't know how you could forgive that. Well, find a way. It's actually liberating. I tell people, you know, did you wrong? I said something wrong? I did something wrong? Forgive me. I'm sorry. That's all I can say. I'll try to do better. I might not, but I'll try. Without it, there's no going forward. The Christian is stuck. God forgives us every day in every way. Over and over and over again. Well, you'd think you'd grow up eventually. Well, maybe. But that's beside the point. The point is, you fail. Have I not presented enough case studies in the Bible with regard to believers and their failures? And how God, Solomon's a case study. Mark dumped Paul on the missionary journey first, and Paul didn't want to forgive him. Paul was real ticked off. Yeah, that'd make it, you know. But all said and done, he mentions Mark at the end of his life, and Mark writes the gospel, one of the four gospels. And people have done worse than that. And we've studied their cases in the Bible. And God is a forgiving God, or we'd all be sunk. He's willing to forgive the worst bunch of sins that quick for anyone who confesses or anyone who makes a salvation adjustment. We sing it in our songs. The worst out there, the worst person out there, find them. They can believe and have instant salvation. These are basic fundamental principles of Christianity. They're at the bedrock of Christianity. You don't have this, what do you got? You don't have nothing. Here the call is different in that this call uses imperatives, is longer, more specific, and there's an emphasis on festivity. There's nothing wrong with having a good time. Nothing. And all those factors that he brings into it. This call expresses an urgency to enjoy life in light of the looming certainty of death. Because where death comes, all activity ceases. Verse 10. I mean, even for the righteous, all activity doesn't cease. You're not going to go to heaven and start gaining more things, as far as I've been able to tell. You're locked into that. And it's a beautiful environment. Whether when it was in the heart of the earth, or whether it's up in the third heaven, right over us. It's a wonderful place. And everybody there is happy. They're not under drugs or anything. They're without a sin nature, and they understand things. The only thing that I ask myself, a believer that's there, it's got the realm of doctrine, must know that they failed in time, for those that didn't make the grade. So there's that. What all the saints up there want that they don't have is a resurrection body. They want that body. You can read about it in 2 Corinthians 5. That's what they want. They're not, okay, this is so beautiful and perfect, I'm happy with this. Whatever form they take up there, and there's some form they take, because you couldn't even see a soul-spirit combination. There's some form, mysterious, whereby you could identify, say, your mother, if you go and you run into her. She was a believer in time. But the resurrection body is universally desired by the people there. If there's anything they want, it's that. The opening imperative, go, which summons followed by eat your bread and drink your wine. These two actions are to be accompanied with happiness and a cheerful heart. Some people can't eat their bread and drink their wine and be happy because they've got other stuff going on. But he advises humanity at large. Do this and enjoy it. It's a gift of God. Of course, for us who are in fellowship and occupied with, thank you for this food, Father. And you can appreciate it and have capacity for it. One should follow this formula because God has already approved or sanctioned your works. He has. He's looking at the human race in general and the human race who works, makes a living, and enjoys the fruit of it. And there was another place in here. He says, even if you come home with very little to show for it, you got your basics. And I tell people to develop capacity for whatever you have, however little, however much. God approves of the activities already. Notice the word already. Suggestion that God is not opposed to these activities, nor do people need to gain divine approval. It's already carte blanche. It's out there. For humanity. It is the portion that God has given to humanity. 9:9 and 5:19. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God. So, what? A rich man, it's a gift of God. Now, there are certain types of rich people that are corrupt, and there's some, I mean, in terms of how they got it, that's another matter. He's just talking about a guy who got it the right way, didn't do anything wrong. And there's those kind of rich people out there. He put together a formula and got wealthy, and then he also deals with the tragedy of the rich man who can't enjoy what he's got due to whatever. In verses 8 through 9, he expands upon the call to enjoyment with an exhortation. Let your clothes be always white, clean, and let oil not be lacking on your head. An ointment. White garments signifies celebration along with ointment. Enjoy life with the woman you love is a call to take pleasure in the divine institution of marriage, which is for the entire human race. The word woman is used without the definite article, but has led some to say just any old woman. But here is referring to not just any woman, but a wife. The fact that Q has been negative towards women does not undermine the benefits associated with marriage. Marriage is a part of the reward God has given to mankind. This bright, positive call to enjoyment, starting with verse 7, begins to turn dark as it moves into verses 9 and 10. This is seen in the phrase, all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun. But this needs to be said to people. Your life's racing by you. I don't think there's any one of us who have lived any length of time on earth that doesn't realize that factor. That it blew by. I mean, you had all the days, all the ups, all the downs, all the this and all that, but it flew by. Even toil and its benefits do not bring lasting profit. 1:3-11. The term fleeting is hevel, which suggests meaninglessness, your meaningless life. your fleeting life, your life of vanity. The Hebel phrase denotes a note of melancholy and resigned finality. Finally, the march towards darkness climaxes in verse 10 with a strong statement to make the most of every opportunity. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Get after it. However bright the prospects of life are, the looming certainty of death overshadows the benefits of life. Death ends all activity, as Q affirms that there is not activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you're going. He opens up the concept to Sheol, the afterlife. I think, I could be wrong, for the very first time in this whole book, there is no mental or physical activity in the realm of the dead. No planning in that sense. People think and are aware of things, but there's no planning. Hey, let's go do this. As far as I know. Certainly not for the unbeliever. Thus, the urgency to enjoy God's portion on earth is the mandate for those who are outside the plan of God in particular. But believers can enjoy his portion too, and you should do it, starting today. Psalm 31:17, a few verses on Sheol. The psalmist prays, "Let me not be put to shame, O Lord, for I call on your name. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them be silent in Sheol." Shut down. Psalm 9:17. "The wicked shall be turned into Sheol, all who forget God." Remember that Sheol is a two-part compartmentalized area, referred to also as the pit. And people who died prior to the ascension of Christ went down. They descended into that place. Their souls, Abraham and Sarah, they descended into Sheol. As did the unbeliever. They were in two separate realms, paradise and Hades. Psalm 49:14-15. "As sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd. And the upright shall rule over them in the morning. And their form shall be for Sheol to consume, so that they have no habitation." No real one. "But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol. He will rescue me." 89:40. However you take that. Sheol, did they anticipate that eventually the saints would be taken out of there? Removed from there? 89:48. "What man can live and not see death? Can he deliver his soul from the power of Sheol?" Answer, no, no, no. We view it from a little different perspective. Now the believer dies and she goes to heaven above and occupies the third heaven. Well, unbelievers still go to Sheol. Psalm 139:8. That's dealing with divine omnipresence. "If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you're there. There's nowhere I can go. God isn't." That was just another one. All right, I'll let you go. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity. May God, the Holy Spirit, enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.